Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
With DoorDash, you can now get even more delivered to your door. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With $0 delivery fees on your first order. Get more from your neighborhood delivered with DoorDash. Terms apply. Visit DoorDash.com.
The most epic story of all is the one you can imagine with Audible. Surround yourself with out-of-the-world adventure. Land yourself a killer case that's yours to solve. And let yourself experience the drive that builds a champion. Epic stories told by your favorite Canadian voices, like Joshua Jackson, Kobe Smulders, and Sidney Crosby. With so many audiobooks, podcasts, and originals, there's more to imagine at audible.ca.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 15th of April, these are our main stories. President Macron's divisive pension reforms have cleared their final legal hurdle, dashing the hopes of French protesters that they might be stopped. A 21-year-old member of the US National Guard has appeared in court over the biggest leak of secret government documents in a decade. Key members of Mexico's Sinaloa cartel have been charged by the US Justice Department with running a huge operation to smuggle fentanyl. Also in this podcast.
3, 2, 1, go.
The European Space Agency's mission known as JUICE successfully launches on its way to explore the moons of Jupiter. France's Constitutional Council has given its approval to President Macron's controversial law to raise the pension age from 62 to 64. The 9-member body, which rules on whether new laws are constitutional, removed some elements of the legislation but retained its essence. In a blow to the bill's opponents, the council also turned down a petition for a referendum to overrule it. President Macron's office now says the new rules will be signed into law within days. Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
Here, outside the Hôtel de Ville, not far from the council's heavily protected headquarters, opponents had gathered in the rain all afternoon. Their reaction was defiant.
The thing is, we know we don't have the power anymore. Nobody is listening to us. Nothing changes. We're just going to keep saying what we want and try to remind Macron that we actually are the one who have the power here because this should be a democracy.
The 9 wise men and women of the council have the job of interpreting Charles de Gaulle's Fifth Republic constitution to see whether new laws do or do not conform. In the case of the pension reform, they'd been petitioned by opposition politicians who said that for a variety of reasons, President Macron's government had broken with constitutional procedure to have the law pushed through Parliament. But the council disagreed. It said that a few minor clauses, for example, one relating to a new contract for older workers, had no part in what was technically a finance bill, so they struck them out. However, the essential heart of the bill, raising the pension age from 62 to 64, that, they said, is not in breach. What this means is that President Macron is now free to have the law promulgated, which he immediately said he'll do in the next 48 hours. The protesters say they have no intention of stopping their movement, but in another blow to the opposition cause, the Constitutional Council also said it will not give the go-ahead for their idea for a referendum on the pension age. A victory then for President Macron? Well, up to a point. He gets his law, but much of the country is outraged, the democratic process is blocked, and his popularity ratings have plummeted. Some victory.
Hugh Schofield there in Paris. Well, Melanie Vogel is a French MP for the Green Party, which opposes the reforms. What does she make of the ruling? She told Julian Marshall.
I'm not going to tell you that we are not very disappointed. Of course we are. We still believe that there were some solid ground to declare the law fully unconstitutional. And I'm not putting into question the legitimacy of the decision. But if it decides that this is in line with our constitution, then my first reaction is we have a big problem with our constitution and we have to change it.
I understood that separately the Constitutional Council has rejected a proposal by the opposition to organise a citizens' referendum on these reforms.
You're right. There was a request to organize a referendum that contained some legally not perfectly sound elements, and that's why we tabled another one. It was registered today, and we will have the answer in a few weeks.
So you're still hoping that a referendum might give you the result that you want, namely a rejection of these pension reforms?
Yes, 70 to 80% of people say they will sign up for the referendum to take place. The overwhelming majority of the French society is against this reform.
But if there is no referendum, what then? Is it back to the streets?
You know, you don't decide when a social movement is going to exist, and you don't decide when it's going to stop existing. The social mobilization is really high because of the reform, but also because of the way basically the government has acted in the last weeks. The popularity of the government is decreasing day after day. And in any case, we haven't won yet, but they have already lost, you know.
Why is there such opposition in France to raising the pension age from 62 to 64 when 64 equates much more closely to that of the age in other European countries?
The impact of this reform is only going to exist for people who started to work very early. And those are the people in the society who generally have the most difficult jobs and who earn the least. It is coming after years and years of government decisions to cut taxes on rich people and on what companies have to pay into the system to finance the pension system. Now the government, after having created a deficit themselves, comes to people and say, well, because of the gift we've been given to companies, the most vulnerable people in the society will have to pay for it.
That was Melanie Vogel of the Green Party in France speaking to Julian Marshall. Let's head to the United States now. And the story dominating the news there is that leak of secret government defense and intelligence documents, which included sensitive information about the war in Ukraine. Well, the man suspected of being behind the leak, 21-year-old Jack Teixeira, has made his first court appearance today in Boston. A junior member of the U.S. National Guard, he could face up to 15 years in prison if he's convicted. Ronald Chapman is a federal defense lawyer and former Marine Corps judge advocate. He thinks a compromise could be reached.
What I would expect out of this case, where the evidence seems pretty clear, this was posted on public social media sites, I would expect a quick plea and some sort of cooperation, which means he may be able to lessen that sentence a little bit by providing the government information about other people who may have also disseminated the same information.
Our North America correspondent Barbara Plett-Archer spoke to me from Boston.
He was charged under the Espionage Act, two counts of unauthorized retention and transmission of defense and classified materials, which, if both stick, he could face up to 15 years in jail. He did not enter a plea, but he will be appearing next week Wednesday again in a detention hearing, and he's been ordered jailed until then. We heard from prosecutors some more detail about how they came to label him their chief suspect. They followed up, for example, billing records from this messaging platform on which he's believed to be active, Discord. They also held interviews with his friends from that platform. And they detected him using his government computer on April 6th. So that's the day after, or the day of, I think, the news broke the story about the classified document. They detected him using his computer searching for the word leak, believe that he was trying to find out more about the investigation into who was responsible. Those were some of the details that came out in the prosecution's statement.
Barbara, we'll hear more about the implications of the leak in a moment. But first, is there a sense of surprise that amongst people there that such a junior member of the National Guard should have had access to these kind of documents in the first place?
Well, it's a question that's being asked. He's got a low-ranking position, and how could he have access to these sort of high-profile intelligence documents. It was mentioned in the court, clarified, that he did have top security clearance since 2021 as part of his job as IT specialist in the intelligence wing of the Air National Guard. So he had the clearance. But that has certainly triggered a lot of thought and discussion in the Pentagon and in the government more widely about who has access to what. And so there are moves to limit the distribution list of some of these intelligence briefings. And Mr. Biden, the president, has also said he's asked for further steps along those lines.
Well, as Barbara was saying earlier, the documents first appeared on the online messaging platform Discord, which is widely used by gamers. Our reporter Mike Wendling has been looking at how the leaks happened and how they spread to so many different corners of the internet.
One of the most damaging leaks of classified information in years appears to have sprung from an attempt to chase online clout. Jack Teixeira was in a small private chat forum devoted to guns, games, and offensive memes. Some of his teenaged online friends have told U.S. media they were baffled when he posted long, complicated, typed-out messages about classified info. Jack Teixeira then started posting pictures of top-secret documents. They might not have spread any further than the 24 or so members of one tiny slice of Discord, a social network popular with gamers that has nearly 200 million users. But others saw an opportunity to also chase clout. Members of the group copied the photos and pasted them in other groups. They were picked up by far-right internet forums and pro-Russian bloggers before getting mainstream attention about a week ago. Now Teixeira faces serious criminal charges, all for what at the moment appears to be an attempt to impress his online friends.
Now let's head to Mexico, because the Sinaloa cartel is an international crime organization that is amongst the most powerful drug smuggling syndicates in the world. But in a blow to its fentanyl trafficking operation, the U.S. Attorney General has announced that charges are being brought against some of its key members. Merrick Garland said the indictments were wide-ranging.
Today, the Justice Department is announcing significant enforcement actions against the largest, most violent, and most prolific fentanyl trafficking operation in the world. That operation is run by the Sinaloa cartel and fueled by Chinese precursor chemical and pharmaceutical companies. The Justice Department is attacking every aspect of the cartel's operations.
Our Mexico correspondent, Will Grant, told me more about those facing charges.
The most standout people to have been charged are the three sons of Joaquin Guzman, El Chapo Guzman, the notorious Mexican drug lord, the former leader of the Sinaloa cartel, currently serving a jail sentence in the United States. His sons are Ovidio Guzman, Jesus Alfredo, and Ivan Archivaldo. Now, Ovidio Guzman is currently under arrest and is expected to end up in the hands of US authorities, but the other two are still at large. They collectively are known as Los Chapitos, the Little Chapos, and they have quite the reputation for controlling the fentanyl trade, for violence, for controlling their cartel with fear. Beyond them, the others refer to financiers, people involved in weapons trafficking, people involved in supplying the chemicals, the precursor chemicals for fentanyl production, lab owners, if you like, links in the chain of the fentanyl drug trafficking trade.
So this is a multinational operation, and it's an extremely lucrative one. Can you give us an idea about how big the fentanyl business is?
I mean, it's huge. It's currently believed to be perhaps worth more, or at least as much, as the cocaine trade these days. That's billions of dollars. The argument from the López Obrador administration is that the fentanyl itself comes in pre-made from China, but much evidence suggests the opposite, that what's coming into Mexico are precursor chemicals. That is then produced here in Mexico and makes its way to the United States. But to give you a number, the number of drug overdoses that have been blamed on fentanyl or synthetic opioids last year was somewhere in the region of 70,000. So, you know, its effects are very, very powerful, very wide-reaching and very lethal.
That was Will Grant. Still to come on this podcast.
I had a room built for Diana memorabilia, and that's full now. That is full.
3 weeks ahead of the coronation of Britain's new king, collecting fever gets underway.
With DoorDash, you can now get even more delivered to your door. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With $0 delivery fees on your first order. Give more from your neighborhood delivered with DoorDash. Terms apply, visit DoorDash.com.
attacker had very good knowledge of banking systems.
$2.1 billion in stolen funds.
It's a cyber criminal group.
It was the Lazarus Group again.
These are smart guys.
The Lazarus Heist is back for a brand new season.
We're following the latest twists and turns in the incredible story of the Lazarus Group hackers.
The Lazarus Heist, Season 2, from the BBC World Service.
Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
The European Space Agency has successfully launched one of its most ambitious projects to date. The Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer, nicknamed JUICE, took off from Kourou in French Guiana this afternoon. The satellite will assess whether Jupiter's icy moons can actually support life. Our science editor, Rebecca Morel, was watching the launch.
3, 2, 1, go!
This was the moment the European Space Agency's mission blasted off, the start of a 4 billion mile journey to the outer solar system. The spacecraft is heading towards three of Jupiter's giant moons, Callisto, Europa and Ganymede. Bleakly beautiful, these worlds are encrusted in thick layers of ice, but this mission will study what lies beneath. Scientists think there are vast oceans 10 times deeper than anything we have on Earth that are kept liquid by a heat source at the moon's core. This could mean conditions exist that are right for life. While this mission won't be searching for extraterrestrial creatures, it will assess whether the moons could be habitable. It will be a while, though, before the discovery can begin. The JUICE spacecraft won't arrive at Jupiter's frozen moons until 2031, but scientists believe the wait will be worth it.
Rebecca Morel. The US President Joe Biden has told well-wishers that it felt like coming home as he concluded his tour of Ireland with a public speech in Ballinar, County Mayo. He added that everything between Ireland and America runs deep. The lively event featured farewell speeches and a rapturous reception as Mr. Biden came out onto the stage. US heavy rock meeting traditional Irish music. Our reporter Charlotte Gallagher was there and watching.
I've never done one of these US presidential visits before, certainly not an event like this. It felt a bit like we're a Hollywood movie. So the cathedral where Joe Biden was speaking outside of is next to the River Moy. And then all of a sudden, Marine One helicopter flies down the River Moy really low and everyone's screaming, everyone's cheering. Then there's lights coming up off the church, there's smoke, there's music. So everyone was getting really, really worked up. And then you could see the blue flashing lights of the motorcade as he approached the cathedral because he got out of the helicopter and got into the beast. So it was quite a moment, especially for people in this small town where who would have thought a few years ago that one of the descendants would turn out to be a US president and one especially who is so proud of his Irish roots. So his speech was really focused on the fact that his family came here and that his great-great-grandfather had to leave because of the famine and he left to America, but he never forgot his Irish roots. And he talked about how Ireland, the island of Ireland, had changed so much. And those days of famine, thankfully, were a thing of a past. But he said Ireland remembered how hard it had been for them, people on the island of Ireland. So they helped other countries now. They helped famine relief. They took in Ukrainian refugees. So the speech was very much a love letter to the Irish Republic, to Ballinar, to County Mayo, to his ancestors. It looked like he was really, really enjoying his time on the stage. He quoted a poem by his great-great-grandfather. He was making jokes about local sports teams. And it really was, when he came out, it was a rock star reception. There were flags waving, US and Irish flags, people screaming even. I've never seen anything like it, but I suppose when you're the US president, this reception you do get when you go places. But I think this was incredibly special for him because it was his homecoming. He was going back to his roots.
That was Charlotte Gallagher. This week marks 9 years since the mass kidnapping of 276 girls from their school in Chibok in northeastern Nigeria. Many have since been released by the Boko Haram militants who abducted them, but 98 still haven't returned home. Their families have once again called on the government to help with their release. Our Africa regional editor Will Ross reminded us what had happened back in 2014.
At first, there was just disbelief that as many as 276 students could possibly have been kidnapped all in one go from one school. And I was there at the time in Nigeria, and we were reporting on it, and we were grilling ministers and saying, what on earth are you doing? And they sort of, when you switch the camera off, they would sort of whisper to you, well, we don't think it is quite as bad as people are saying. And they were constantly trying to downplay the scale of what clearly was a shocking abduction that had taken place. So it then took a long time until it seemed that the military were then really engaged to try and go after them and try and rescue these girls.
And yet, 9 years on, still almost 100 of these girls, or now young women, presumably, are still missing. Obviously, the family members have called on the government to do more. What can be done now? It's going to be very difficult.
It is very difficult. I've just spoken to somebody who was in Chibok just 2 days ago, and he told me that there's very sort of mixed feelings amongst the parents who are still in this terrible limbo. Some, you know, still hold on to this hope that they haven't heard that their daughters are dead. Therefore, they hold on to that hope and they think that one day they'll come out. Others, he told me, have simply given up because it has been so long and they've just heard absolutely nothing. But over these last, you know, 9 years, there have been various attempts to free them, and there have been negotiations involving the Swiss government, the Red Cross, and there were groups of these girls who were released back in 2016 and 17. Since then, it's been more of a kind of trickle, especially as Boko Haram have been under military pressure and some of them have surrendered. So it's difficult to know what the government can do, but what I was told was that there is a feeling that over the last year or two, there hasn't really been much of a response, much comment at all, really, from the government about the plight of these 98 who are still missing.
Meanwhile, across the country, abductions of young people, young women, teachers, young boys as well, has really exploded, hasn't it?
That's possibly why the focus has gone away from Chibok, those students who are still missing, because the insecurity has over the last few years got so bad. I mean, going back to early last year, you know, we were in a situation where hundreds and hundreds of students were being abducted, but this time not by Boko Haram, but by criminal gangs who were simply after a ransom payment. And then there's other insecurity in the southeast of the country with secessionists trying to break away. So the general insecurity in Nigeria has got so bad that the focus kind of shifted away from the northeast, where there has been some success against the jihadists. But it's staggering that, as you say, 9 years later, still 98 of these young women missing.
Will Ross. For Muslims around the world, the holy month of Ramadan happening right now is a time of reflection, contemplation and celebration. For a group of men in the Egyptian town of Dakhalia, northeast of Cairo, that means playing in the annual Mit Rumi Ramadan football tournament. It's been held since 1975, and what started out as a bit of street football has become a lavish affair. They've even invented a low-budget but effective video assistant referee system, or VAR, as the BBC's Alaa Rajai reports from Cairo.
For many years, amateur football players in Egypt used to compete in the streets during the holy month of Ramadan in what's so-called Ramadan tournaments. This year, a more lavish tournament appeared in Al-Mansoura city in the Nile Delta, where locally video assistant referee VAR system is used. With around 15 mobile phones strategically placed around the stadium, connected to a computer to detect offside shots, and a primitive walkie-talkie to communicate with the referee. This locally made system was originated by Saad Khalifa, who has been working as a computer technician.
When I watch the matches, I can see a lot of arbitrary mistakes. That's why I came up with the low-budget VAR. It's not fancy as the one used in Premier League, yet it can bring justice and almost 80% fair play.
This tournament kicked off in a style, with music, shows and fireworks in the opening ceremony. 3, 2, 1, 0. Around 23 amateur teams representing neighborhoods and villages youth centers are taking part in this competition. They play in groups in a local five-a-side pitch, and the top teams advance to knockouts. The trophy for the winner is a locally made cup and a small financial prize. All this is set up by the local community without official funding, only participation fees and voluntary efforts, according to the tournament organizers, who say they face many challenges. Tariq Abu Skandar is one of the organizers.
We face many problems here, in fact. Some problems can affect the game and cause it to be stopped. And since we offer the winner a valuable reward, so sometimes we see violence and witness violent tackles by the players. So if it wasn't for the newly system we are using on the VAR, this might ruin the match and even the whole tournament. So that's why we are using the VAR. And if we have the facilities, we can even offer this service to the Premier League.
Some of the players here are chasing their dreams to be professional athletes, indulging their passion for the game and showing off their skills. Ahmed Samir is one of those.
We have highly skilled players. They are even can be ranked as the professional football players, and even better. That's what attracts people to come and watch as they enjoy the matches.
The new version of Ramadan tournaments is increasingly attracting very great attention from teams, fans, and even sponsors, while some tournaments are now hosted by sports clubs.
Ala Rajai reporting. Now, a coffee mug for $37, a set of souvenir spoons for $50, a competitively priced tea towel, yours for just $14. All of this and more items available from the Royal Collection Trust to allow Britons and others around the world to celebrate and to cherish the moment of the King's coronation just 3 weeks away. Some people may scoff, but many, many people will buy. One of them is Margaret Tyler, one of the country's foremost collectors of royal memorabilia. Johnny Diamond asked her about the sort of things she's got in her collection.
Oh, anything and everything. Anything with a royal mark on it or stamp on it or whatever, or has got a link to the royal family, then I buy it. I've got four rooms full. So you
four
can
rooms?
Count. Yes, I had a room built for Diana memorabilia. And that's full now. That is full.
You had a room specially built?
Yes, yes. I didn't think the council were going to let me, but they did, so I kept going.
And again, those few that don't collect this kind of thing, what sort of things have you got?
Mostly china, because I do like china an awful lot. But there's all sorts of things. You know, there's royal dogs. They're not real dogs.
sort of china dogs.
Yes, yes.
Right. A lot of mugs,
plates. Yes, yes. I've probably got something like 150 mugs, I would think.
150. Do you focus on any particular member of the royal family, or do you like to have them all represented?
Well, I like them all, really. The other ones you don't see so much of, do you? I mean, you don't see so much of Princess Anne, do you? And yet she's fantastic at what she does. Mm. And Sophie is very good as well. She's a great help to the Queen when she was alive.
Now the Duchess of Edinburgh, of course.
Yes, oh, no, I know. It sounds good, doesn't it?
Forgive me for asking, but do you use the plates and the mugs and the tea towels, or is it strictly for having on the shelf and looking at?
Well, it's mostly for showing, but I mean, if you had a few friends round, they'd all want a royal mug. They'd want to be left out, you know what I mean?
Right. Is there a favourite item in your collection?
Oh, there's a painting of Diana when the boys were quite young, and it's in the Diana room, obviously, yeah. And it's one of my favourite pictures of her.
And slightly delicate question, what about the royals who have sort of rather retired from their roles? Do you go through your collection and sort of turf their mugs or tea towels out?
No, I don't do that, because they are still of royal blood, aren't they?
Indeed.
Still, you know what I mean?
You can't take that away from them.
No, exactly.
That was Margaret Tyler. And that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Alice Adderley and was mixed by Wayne Moses. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
National Car Rental has your back, road warriors, because we know you're picking up the pace, steering life at 10 and 2. You're hitting the road, and National's helping you get there with the confidence of our complete clean pledge. So skip the counter without missing a beat and choose any car in the aisle. National Car Rental. Go like a pro. Subject to availability and other restrictions, requires enrollment in the complimentary Emerald Club.
The most epic story of all is the one you can imagine with Audible. Surround yourself with out-of-the-world adventure. Land yourself a killer case that's yours to solve. And let yourself experience the drive that builds a champion. Epic stories told by your favorite Canadian voices, like Joshua Jackson, Kobe Smulders, and Sidney Crosby. With so many audiobooks, podcasts, and originals, there's more to imagine at audible.ca.